That entire Todd Rundgren story was amazing, but just for clarification, was that Mumbo?
Yeah.
Okay, that was Mumbo's brain. All right, all right.
Hi, this is Chris Poland of OHM, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
That should be OHM, you know, right? You know,
yeah, next it would be OHM, and OHM is who opened for Deep Purple. So okay. Actually, that was my first experience at the House of Blues. And I think that's why the next time I was there, I was wondering like what kind of reception we were going to get. But
got it.
But yeah, so then after that, something, we couldn't get a deal, man. And I just got so tired of it that I said, you know what, I'm done. And I just quit playing for a little bit.
Okay.
And then I called up Robert Pagliari, one day, and I said, hey, man, no matter what I do, I can't get arrested, man. Let's just play the kind of music we like to play, and whatever happens, happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So we started, you know, a three-piece power trio playing, you know, like, fusion rock.
Yeah. Amino acid flashback, baby.
Yeah, and the thing is I'm the rock and he's the fusion.
Right.
You know? And then the drummer is like the icing on the cake, you know?
Sure, sure. I don't think I knew about OHM until maybe a second or a third album, but I kept getting suggestions from friends of mine. You always hear these random progressive band names, and there's so many of them out there, you never go check them out. And of course, a band like Umphrey's McGee sticks out because the name is so silly, you know? And,
oh, yeah.
You know, you have like these Symphony X and these bands that are like trying to take themselves too seriously and titles that just come across as exactly like what they are. And then you have like Umphrey's McGee, which is like kind of silly, right?
Right.
So OHM and Umphrey's McGee kind of smashed together and formed something called OHMfrey. And I was like, okay, wait a minute. There's this band that everybody says I'm supposed to be listening to who has a phenomenal rhythm section. And Chris Poland from Megadeth was in a fusion band with that fretless bass player guy. Wait a minute. And they all formed one. Hold on. And they, hold up. So I went and dug out that OHMfrey album. And man,
oh, shit.
Shit's a game changer, man. I think that's the first time I ever heard you was in OHMfrey. And then I worked my way backwards into the OHM stuff. Wow.
I wanted to go back. I think the timeline is after Mumbo's, I think I did a record called Chasing the Sun.
Yes, you did.
Right after that.
I completely forgot about that. Yep.
Yeah, I did too. So, and that's when I had Francis DeCosmo playing bass, and then I had Pag come in and play on a couple tunes. And after he came in and played, that's when I got the idea, like, you know, man, let's just do that. Because I couldn't, I couldn't get that anyone to do anything with that either. So
right, right. Were you guys still playing locally? Like, it seems like you're at the Baked Potato every other weekend, and that's a West Coast thing. I don't even know what that is. I'm not going to act like I know. You know.
Yeah, no, it's just a jazz club.
Right. So were you playing out in like local jazz clubs and couldn't get a deal, or like you couldn't even get gigs?
Oh, we could get gigs, but you know, I couldn't play that. I would need a second guitarist to do that record.
Got it.
Properly, you know.
Okay. All
right. So I think that's when, not sure if it's like the right timeline, but I know that what happened was is I eventually got a hold of Pag and said, hey, man, let's just do what we like.
Yeah. And then first, forgive me if I'm wrong about this, first drummer was David Eagle, right?
Oh, no, actually, it was a guy named Coco Bermejo.
You're right. I remember the name because Coco would stick out. Okay, all right.
Yeah, he was a God. He was an amazing jazz drummer. But the thing was, he was a concert piano player. Like he went to a conservatory, and we didn't know that, you know. And then one day he walked up to a piano and started playing a Latin version of Giant Steps and soloing over the top of it. And me and Pag just went, huh?
Right.
And he goes, oh yeah, man. He used to always say that. Yeah, man. I could play piano, man.
Why is our drummer a better piano player than he is a drummer? Wow.
Yeah, he's a debutante, man. He comes from his mother owns an island and all the cattle on it and the airport. And I mean, but you wouldn't know it meeting him in L.A. because the only thing in the studio was an ashtray filled to the top with butts, a piano, a drum set, and a giant picture of John Coltrane on the wall.
And he comes.
That was it.
And he comes from a family who owns an island and an airport.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, couldn't care less about money.
Wow. Okay.
I think he has a record deal in Asia playing on Blue Note now.
Okay. Very cool. Then enter David Eagle?
Yes. And David Eagle was, his room was right next to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't realize it, but he used to play along with us. Next thing I know, it's like he comes up and he goes, and this is after he knew Coco was gone. He goes, hey, man, let me come in and jam with you guys. And that was that.
A lot of your stories have a common thread. And I know you alluded to it in the beginning. But a lot of your stories have to do with the fact that there was a room right up the hall. Geography. A lot of geography in your history where it had to do with, like, right place, right time. But it almost seems like, how could it not be the right place, right time? You're all in the same damn building, right?
Yeah, well, that's funny you say that, because the reason how Coco got in the band was I had this room at Nick Payne's rehearsal places out in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And Coco had a room there. And I would go in there during the day. I wasn't working. I was just kind of writing material. And I was actually working with Carol MacArthur. And I kept hearing him play drums. And I kept saying, I mean, that sounds like Vinny.
Mm.
And so I went and knocked on his door, and that's when I saw a piano, a huge ashtray, a drum set, and a picture of Coltrane. And I said, hey, man, I've been hearing you play for the last month or two, and I was just wondering, man, do you want to start a band with me? And he goes, yeah, man. And that was so awesome, man. So then I think that we had... We had Dave Randy play bass for us, and Carol MacArthur sang. And we were trying to do this kind of weird far left field pop thing that still had a lot of, like, you know, weirdness to it.
Okay.
And that didn't work out either. But I think Steve Bauer made us release it, and I think that's called Rare Tracks.
Yes, I remember that too. The reason I bring up the room and the geography thing is because... You mentioned in the beginning that one of your main business, I guess your main income, your main business right now is the fact that you're running a football field-sized building full of practice space, and you've been doing it for 20 years. That's exactly overlapping with this era that we're talking about. So do you have this building at this time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, the building that we had Coco and David Eagle, the original building, we lost our lease a couple years ago.
Okay.
So now we just have the big football building.
Okay, but you got into the business of having practice rehearsal space and studio space and everything at quite some time ago while you were running around and doing all these bands. How did one generate the capital or even the idea to get
into it? No, dude. I started at the bottom. I started at the bottom, man. I took out the trash. I swept the floors. Dino from Fear Factory saw me sweeping the floors one day and said, Mike Doherty, he's the GM, he's my boss.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, hey, Mike, who is that guy? He goes, oh, that's Chris. He works here now. But he didn't say that's Chris Poland from Megadeth. He just said, that's Chris.
Right.
And so I started there, and then we found the big building that I've been at for 20 years. And this is 6 months after I started.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked my ass off because I really needed a job,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't going to just like live off like, you know, Megadeth money, and I needed more money. I wanted to buy a house, and my boss comes up to me and goes, "Hey man, we're going to take that building across the street. I need you to go over there and sweep it out." So I swept it out. We took the fourth floor. There was nothing in there. It was totally open space.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went in. And we measured, we did a plan, and we put like 100 rooms on that space.
Mm-hmm.
And then me and my brother Mark and Mike, we basically, you know, headed up all the construction on it. And it was funded by the guy that owns Stone Brewing, Arrogant Bastard Ale.
Stuff.
Yeah, Greg Cook. He was big. I mean, he started this whole rehearsal thing in San Francisco. He had 280 rooms up there.
Oh,
some .com company came in and bought it from him. He had bought it for $6 million. He sold it to them for $16 million.
All right.
Then started his brewery, which became immensely successful.
Yeah, Stone is. Are you a beer drinker?
No. But
Stone's amazing.
He also managed bands. He managed, one of the bands was, remember that video with the bumblebee?
The girl dressed as a bumblebee?
Yeah, remember, and it was a big pop.
Blind Melon?
Yeah, he managed Blind Melon, and then the other guy, Stanley, was the lead singer, and he was always dressed in a black suit with really thick black rimmed glasses, and he was just a total freak.
Stanley.
He managed those two bands.
Wait, hold up. The guy who runs Stone managed Blind Melon?
Yeah.
Get the hell out of here, dude.
Yeah, and then somehow they screwed him over. And he'd already, you know, he was in this whole rehearsal thing, and they screwed him over, and I think he just got a bad taste in his mouth. He goes, I'm not dealing with these people.
Okay.
There's a guy up in San Francisco on the first floor of the building that he owned. They had a microbrewery. And so they would talk all the time, and he was really intrigued by it. And one day he just said, you know what? I'm doing it. And he's that kind of guy. I mean, it's like anything he, you know, he's got the Midas touch, man.
Right. Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah, he's my ultimate superior, you could say.
The guy from Stone Brewing.
Yeah, he's my big boss.
I was just drinking his beer last night.
You know what? I'm going to tell him that.
I mean, seriously, I'm an IPA guy. I like the more bitter the beer, the better. And he makes one called, it's called something like a drink by date. He puts them out with a date on it. You're supposed to drink them by a certain date. And,
right.
I just stole a couple out of my buddy's, fridge yesterday. They were drink by, the 25th. They were like a Christmas IPA. And I was like, I'll take these if you're not going to drink them. So, yeah, I love Stone shit, man. It is great. Tell them I said so. Okay, so Dino from Fear Factory, did he recognize you? Or did he just wonder?
No. He didn't know. I don't think so.
Okay.
Eventually, when we built the other place, he finally realized, you know, who I was. And,
right.
I mean, not like he gave a crap, but, you know.
I got you.
But now, I mean, I see him all the time. You know, it's like, hey, Dino, what's up?
So, you alluded to one thing, and I don't want to get personal because it's none of my or any listener's business, but you said, I had to get a job. I didn't want to live on Megadeth money. I wanted to buy a house. Was there any?
Oh, yeah. No, when I got my Metalopolis deal with Enigma,
mm-hmm.
it was originally on Capitol Records.
Okay.
And it still was. But Dave kept asking me to join Megadeth again.
Really?
And I actually was like, I was 99% going to join Megadeth. And then Jamie, who was managing me, for 2 days, she told me, if you join that band, you're going to die. Because I had been, I'm totally sober now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not 100% sure that they are, you know. And
at this time, you mean?
Yeah. And right. She said, if they're not sober and you join the band, you're not going to make it. Because she said, the first time I met her, I was coming off the bus going into the Santa Monica Civic Center to do a gig.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at Andy Somers, our agent, and she said, he's going to be dead in a month.
Mm.
And something happened. I just, all of a sudden, I just hit bottom. After you know, the firing, which was basically, I was late for a meeting, a Megadeth meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get a ride. You know, I didn't have a car. I couldn't get there. Finally get there. Dave's gone, so I can't get my $200 per diem. So I have no money. So I call him up on the phone. I said, Dave, I couldn't get a ride. I'm here now. And he goes, well, I don't care. You're not getting paid. And so I said, you know what, man? Why don't you fire me? And I said, oh, wait, I know why you won't fire me. Because I don't think there's anybody that would put up with how you treat people.
Mm.
And then we had a big blowout. And 2 days later, I get a letter at my girlfriend's house that says, from Lenny Kropotkin, saying, your services are no longer needed and have a good life. And I was like, whoa. And that's when I hit bottom. About a month after that, I just, you know, I had no money. I was totally in a bad place. I finally just called home, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. What, if you don't mind me asking, what was the, when you were talking about being sober, what was the, what was going on in the band that everybody was afraid that you would fall back into? Sounds like a little more than just drinking a beer after a show, huh?
Oh, yeah, and everybody knows that story. We don't need to go into that.
No, that's fine. But I mean, like, no, you're right. We don't need to go into it. What I meant was you were sober at the time, and you weren't doing any of that stuff, and Megadeth still was, and he was asking you to come back?
Yeah, pretty much. And I didn't know that for sure, but
gotcha.
They're, you know, it's just rumors. And
gotcha. Okay.
And then Jamie finally said, hey, man, you just got yourself a deal. You know, you have a deal to do what you love doing.
Sure. Well,
why are you going to do that? And I said, you know what? You're right. So, and I'm not saying she talked me out of it, mm-hmm. but she was just the voice of reason. And I thought, you know what? You're right. And there's a chance it could happen, you know, that I could start using again. And I thought, you know what? You're right.
Sure.
So anyway, at the table, you know, they had told me that Marty Friedman was on the block for, you know, for the position. I thought, well, you know what? That makes it easy for me because Marty's a freaking animal, you know, it's like,
he's pretty good.
So I said, hey, why don't you guys use Marty? Because, you know, I have this deal. I've worked very hard for it. And it was on Capitol, right? So they're upset. And granted, I understand because they, you know, they did all this work with our attorneys. And I'm sure that that they felt like I did that just to get that money. But that's not what it was about. It was about, let's make everything level here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I didn't need money for drugs anymore. I just wanted what me and Gar were due. We kind of got like tossed to the side there. You know, I think they thought Gar was going to die.
Hmm.
Yeah. So no, I have my deal on Capitol. Next thing I know, I don't have a deal at Capitol. Yeah.
Right.
All of a sudden, I have a deal on Enigma now because. It's a mystery to me to this day. And I'm not going to say it out loud, but I have a feeling it had something to do with what happened at that table when Marty got the gig in Megadeth. So anyway, Now I'm on Enigma. Enigma, the it's a subsidiary of Capitol.
Right.
But to make me feel better, they gave me like an extra $50,000. It's like, okay.
Yeah, $50,000 feels pretty good.
Yeah, so, so now, I'm doing my thing. And I don't have to worry about, because nobody in my band does drinks or does drugs.
Thank you for being so open and honest about that stuff. It sounds like not fun to relive, some of it, anyway.
Yeah, man, it's, and you know what? I got to tell you, Nick was there when I did the demos.
Rick.
I'm sorry. I was thinking of Nick Menza was Nick. There. He was there, and I shook his hand and said hi, and that was the only thing, interaction between us.
Right.
And I've said this before, man, because when I started playing with Nick, we became fast friends, and it was, if I had went to lunch with Nick, I probably would have joined the band.
Give me a moment. Hold on. Give me a moment to think about Chris Poland back in Megadeth at the time that Rust in Peace came out. I can't wrap my head around that album without Marty Friedman, but who knew that it was one sandwich away from being totally different?
Yeah, but it wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be how it is, but it's just that me and Nick would have hung, and Dave would have hung just like before.
Sure.
But I don't think Nick had anybody to hang with, because Marty was very introverted and just kind of, I'm not exactly sure. I just think that, I think Marty was more, totally, the consummate professional and did not like F around a lot,
Sure. So you have a very in and out, open door sort of relationship with Megadeth almost your entire career, because you were in it and then you left because of the t-shirt thing. Then you came back. Then you did Peace Sells. Then you left. Then there was talk of you coming back again. And then you left. Then you did come back in 2004. And then you left. Like, it sounds like, you and Mustaine never had a big old fuck you, don't ever talk to me again moment. Because, obviously you're still talking to each other, right?
Well, no, because when I did the thing with Vinny,
System has failed.
Mm-hmm. He was working on the demos, adding the demos to a re-release of Rust in Peace. And I wasn't going to get paid. But I didn't realize that until it came out. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm not getting paid for this. And then I tried to call Dave, at least a dozen times. And I never heard back from him. Then I called Dave's manager a dozen times, and he wouldn't get back to me. So the last time I called him, I said, hey, man, if you don't call me back, I'm going to call Owen Sloan, and we're going to have to get into it. And he calls me back and totally insults me.
How so?
Saying, you played a couple solos, so what? And I'm like, what do you mean, so what? Dave thought you would do it for the fans. And I said, okay, well, is everybody else that played on that demo doing it for the fans? Are they getting paid?
Good question.
And he said, Chris, that's not the point. So anyway, I said, listen, man, we have to do something here. I'm not just going to walk away. I love the fans, but, I'm just not going to do it. It's like, if everybody else is getting performance royalty for this, I want one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as I wanted to go with that.
Okay.
But I just I want everybody to know that it wasn't a nuisance suit. It wasn't anything like that, man. I made every attempt to work it out, and they just ignored me.
Hmm. Okay.
There's a thing with Dave. Dave is like, he knows what he wants, and as long as he's not like crazy drunk, he's a great guy.
Mm-hmm. You happen to catch him in the crazy drunk years.
Yeah, but when we did the System Has Failed, it was awesome, man. It was fun. It was a learning experience. I met Ralph Patlin, who helped me mix my next record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the thing about Dave Mustaine, you know what you're getting with Dave Mustaine. He doesn't hide anything. He doesn't, it's not like a mystery. Anyway, so let's talk about something else.
Moving on. I'm not touching that. I'm happy that you closed the loop on how you met Nick Menza, because I'd love to hear. I'm under the understanding, rest in peace, Dave Eagle passed away. Is that when Nick got the call?
Yeah, you know what? We had started a project, me and Nick. Rob, Nick's manager, started calling me and saying, hey, you want to start a project with Nick Menza. And when I first got the call, I was like, I don't know. Maybe I do. I don't know. And he kept calling and calling and calling. And so I finally agreed. So it was going to be Nick, me, and James Lomenzo.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, hey, this is cool. This could be cool, right? So me and Nick and James get together. And we're starting to work some stuff out, and I got a fire under my ass. I'm writing as many songs as I can, and I really like what I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day James Lomenzo comes in and goes, yeah, I had my people kind of count the beans here, and they said even if we do something, I'm not going to make any money. So, but I'm still willing to help you along with the project, but And I just looked at, Nick looks at me, and so he leaves, and we're like, man, do you want a guy like that? Like, in the back, don't you want somebody that's like, going to go to the end?
Right.
You want somebody that's going to be there, hanging on to the end, that's going to give their all,
Right.
So me and Nick just kind of said, well, we're going to have to look for somebody. And then all of a sudden, Dave... David Eagle passed away, man. It was terrible, man. And
I can't imagine.
God bless him, man. He was like one of the best drummers that ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
If people would hear him play, like when they heard some of the stuff he played on recordings, they'd go, "How many do you guys have a percussionist?" And that's Dave, man. He's playing drums and percussion at the same time. He played with Willie Bobo for 10 years. And so he learned all this Afro-Cuban stuff, and he was the original drummer in Oingo Boingo. I mean,
being a drummer, I get curious about guys' setups, especially when I hear some of the unique patterns and stuff. In my head, I'm just thinking, like, how is he pulling that off? It's not the typical, how you just assume everybody sets up their drum set like it is in the catalog from Guitar Center, right, left, around, right? And then you Google a couple pictures of Dave Eagle's setup, and you're like, whoa! What the hell's that dude doing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know what, though? In the end, if you look at, his last performance was at, that you could actually see, was the Schecter party.
Uh-huh.
About 3-4 years ago. Well, maybe longer than that now. But anyway, he rented a really nice drum set, and it was totally stripped down. It had no bells and whistles, man, and he played his butt off.
Murdered it, right? Okay. So... after Dave's passing away, and again, I'm sorry, my condolences to him and anybody who knows him or family that might be hearing this and everything. Wow, bummer. Then Nick, okay. Wow, pump the brakes.
Here's what happened.
So you and Nick sounds like you were trying to start a band, and then because of Dave's passing, you were like, oh, you want to be an Ohm?
No, it wasn't like that.
Okay.
We wanted to do a benefit for Adam. For David's son.
Okay.
And for Aviva. And, his ex-wife.
Okay.
And so we're kicking it around. How are we going to do it? And then one day I just said, hey, Nick, do you think? And he goes, yeah, man, I can try. I can try and play that stuff. And so we started rehearsing. And then he just kept getting better. Every rehearsal, it was just getting better and better and better. And then it was like, he goes, dude, let's just do this. And I said, okay, I'm not opposed to that, but we still had all this stuff we wanted to get a vocalist on. And so, we had a lot of things, on different burners that we could, any way we wanted, we could go,
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that. We did the benefit. Nick had a blast. If he dropped the ball on something, at the end of the song, he'd go, four. you know, like when a golfer hits a ball, like it's about to hit somebody in the head.
Right.
But then he got like just so good, man. I mean, he just was nailing it. He brought the band to a different place that we're trying to stay at now.
Mm-hmm.
Like he just gave it muscle and he made hard parts, you know, that were in like 7/8 sound like you dance to it, you know.
Nice.
You know, where it wasn't like math anymore. It was like it had soul, you know.
Swing. I've said it. I've been quoted on a podcast talking about Nick after he passed away. He added some sort of some dimension of swing in metal.
Yeah, man. Yeah, his father, geez, Don Menza, one of the best sax players alive.
Horn player, right. Like, back then, the Big Four, it was very straight down the middle, right, left, 16th note, just chase the rhythm guitar, and something about Rust in Peace, he had this da-da-da-da-da-da sort of a backbeat to it, and not a lot of metal bands were pulling that off, because I bet if you isolate just what Mustaine and Marty are doing, it sounds like just bombastic, batshit crazy, right? But Nick would add this kind of a element to a metal song, and that's not easy to pull off. It's just in your blood, man. It's in your DNA.
I don't know. Have you ever talked to Nick?
No, I never had the...
I have to tell you why, man. Nick's dad was the sax player for Buddy Rich's band.
Mm-hmm. I did know that. Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but Nick worked at like a shop in town. His dad got him a gig there where he made upright basses for jazz guys.
Nick did?
And he ran that shop, you know, with the guy, and he did a lot of work, and they would make him linseed oil, like these upright basses for like 6 months, and Nick would come in and go, do I have to do it again? He goes, one more time. And so anyway, Nick became Buddy Rich's drum tech whenever he was in L.A.
What?
Yep.
I did not know that.
I don't know how, I'm not exactly sure how many times, but the story I heard was Nick was there, and Buddy Rich threw him a bag of pot and said, Menza, can you roll a joint? And he went, yeah. And he goes, well, get going.
He was that kind of drum tech.
No. And then after that, he started like watching him. He sat behind that drum set watching Buddy Rich play drums.
Wow.
Like not more than one time, man. This was like whenever they were in town, Nick was watching him.
The first time I ever saw a drummer perform, it was Buddy Rich on the Muppet Show. When he did a
pretty amazing.
He did a drum battle with Animal, and he went backstage and he was like up and down like the ladder and stuff, and he was like he was like cracking jokes while he was playing. When I play the stage, I actually play the stage or something. And I just remember being a kid and being like, man, that looks like a lot of fun. I'd like to try that someday.
Yeah.
So that's neat that Nick got to do that for Buddy Rich of all people. Who knew? My God, at the risk of sounding morbid, you were one of the closest people to Nick when he actually passed away. I mean, physically, he passed away on stage, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, man.
Again, at the risk of sounding morbid, can you kind of take us inside your head that evening?
No, we're there. We sound checked. Everything's cool. Nick goes with his tech. They go get something to eat. He comes back. And we get on stage. And it's like a different drummer arrived. Like, and I had been playing with Nick for a couple years now. And he's playing the drums like I had never heard him play drums before. Like, I'd never heard him play. I mean, not even close. And I'm trying to keep up with the intensity. It's not the volume intensity. It's just how intense he was playing it.
Hmm.
And it was loud, too, but it was just like something was like, he had a fire under his butt, man. So
are you implying better? Or he was like not feeling well and was off?
No. It was the best I ever heard him play drums.
Okay.
But it was like in my head, when I think about it now, it's like every other time I heard him play drums, he was holding back. It was like he was playing half what he played that night at the Baked Potato. And we get to the end of the first song, and I look at him like, what is going on with you? And he just laughed. And so we get to the end of the second song. Now I'm sweaty already, because normally I'm not sweating until the fourth song. I got sweat dripping off my nose, and he's still laughing. So we get to the end of the third song, which I think was Peanut Buddha. And now him and Pag are laughing at me because I'm like totally all disheveled and soaking wet. My guitar, where my right arm is hitting the body, is all wet. And I'm drying myself off. And I said, are you okay? And he said that to me. He goes, dude, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm good. And he tightened his hi-hat and he set his hands down on his lap. And then he just leaned over into the monitor. And I thought he was fucking with me. And he's still there. And I said, hey, man, let's go. And then I thought, of course, he's messing with me. And I said, Nick, come on, man. And I look over and his eyes are open. And that's when I knew that something had happened. And I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't believe it all night. I could not believe what was happening. And when I finally realized what was happening... That's what I need.
I'm sorry, man. He gave no indication whatsoever that anything was wrong. He was even giggling with you right before it happened.
Yeah, man. It was just crazy. I haven't talked about that, and I don't like to talk. He was just playing like that, and then that happened. Every time I think about it, this freaks me out. So I try not to think about it.
That's really sad. I thought for sure you were going to say, he went to dinner with his tech, he came back, and something was wrong. Something was off. Like, he wasn't feeling good. He was playing off. He was behind the beat. And you kept turning around saying, you okay? And he kept saying, yeah, okay. I thought for sure. I was positive that's how your story was going to go. He just blew my mind that somehow he was playing at his absolute peak when he left. That's kind of ass backwards and crazy.
He kept going up north to visit his sons. And we didn't, you know, I'm not going to bother not to go see his sons.
Right.
But I didn't know, I couldn't, we needed rehearsals for stuff that was coming up. And I one day I asked Pag, I said, do you think he's kind of not into it anymore or something? And that wasn't the case at all. He was just going to see his kids. And anyway, at the memorial, I spoke to his ex-wife and her new husband. And Nick was up there helping them install a fence in their backyard. And they're having their, locker room talk, two guys talking.
Okay.
Somehow, Nick's ex-wife's husband says, you know what? I want to go out having sex. And Nick was totally like, dude, come on.
My ex-wife.
Not only that, that's too traumatizing, bro. What? And so he goes, well, how are you going to go out? He goes, I'm going to go out playing my drums. And right there, I looked at his arm. The hair on his arm was standing up. And they both just started shivering. And I was like, oh, my God.
Oh, man. Now you got me choking up. You know how many times I listen to that fucking record, dude?
Yeah, no, that's a true story, man.
Man.
And not only that, HBO, or guys affiliated with HBO, were doing this documentary on us, How Do You Replace a Drummer in a Band? And this was after David Eagle passed.
Mm-hmm.
And James and Madison... were at his house, and he was making them breakfast. And he kept saying all these questions that he had for God. about all these things. And, you know, you don't think of, you know, you're not thinking about, you know, 3 weeks later when the worst happened, you know. But when you put it all together, I don't know, you know. And, but I loved him, man.
Never heard a bad word about him.
He was the best. He was such a good person, man. He would do anything for anyone. And if he was your friend, you knew it, and you knew that no matter what you asked, he would do it.
Installing a fence for his ex-wife and her new husband. Yeah, I mean, sounds like a forgiving, let's move on kind of a guy, right?
Yeah, no, he was an old soul, man. He was crazy in a good way.
Right, right.
I mean, if I'd go to his house and he'd be making cajones, you know, those things you sit on, the percussion things.
Oh, right.
He'd be making them by hand, like from scratch.
Wow.
You know, and if he wasn't doing that, he'd be like, he invented this tuning using bass strings and stuff on an electric guitar. And he wanted to do some of the songs he wrote. So I gave him one of my guitars and I said, make it happen. And so he took it, built it. He was a luthier, man. I mean, anything he set his mind to, there was like, there was no even thought of failure.
I like that story. That's cool.
When he met Mustaine, he thought Mustaine was giving him a drum gig. Mustaine gave him a gig being a drum tech. And so, not to be outdone, he said, okay, I'll tech for this guy. And so he would tech and sound check the drums. I probably took Dave two, three sound checks to realize that he had a monster drummer as a tech and an adequate drummer in the band. And the rest is history, you know. That's Nick. He's like, I know what to do.
Cool. What are you doing next? What's Ohm doing?
Like I said, we're playing Wednesday. Wednesday before NAMM out here in LA. And then I'll be at the Stone Tone booth at 2 and 4 all 4 days.
This isn't going to come out till after NAMM anyway, so.
Oh, well, I got to tell everybody about this amp. It's the Boss Katana.
Okay.
It's really inexpensive, man. It's like, I think the head, the 100-watt head that's MIDI, is $300.
Okay.
Anyway, I ran into it. I did Summer NAMM, and one of the guys there worked for Boss, and so he had a 50-watt version, like a combo there, and I plugged into it, and to this day, I'm still, like, scratching my head how an amp, like, a solid-state amp can sound like that.
Okay.
So any guitar players out there, man, go just plug in a Katana and sit with it for 20 minutes.
Okay.
And let me know what you think.
I have a lot of guitar players out there that listen to this show. That's cool.
Yeah. For the money, it's cheaper than an expensive pedal. You know what I mean? Most pedals are like, good pedals are $250-$300.
Uh-huh.
You can get a combo for like $250. And man, you'll be selling that pedal you thought was worth $250 in about 5 minutes. I don't work for Boss. I'm not affiliated with them at all, man. I just, when I run into something like that, I need people to know, just so. A friend of mine up north, he lives in San Francisco. I told him about it. I told him how cheap it was. He called me last night and said, dude, I got the Katana.
You sold somebody on it.
Yeah, and he goes, I said, what do you think? And he goes, oh. Yeah. I mean, he played,
I don't have enough listeners. I don't have enough listeners that you're going to generate enough of a case to get a kickback.
He plays Friedman amps, and he plays these serious boutique amps. And he said, "Man, this amp is it's an anomaly, man. It's just crazy."
Wow. Okay.
But you have to send me a link. After that, we're thinking about we got Carlos Cruz is playing drums with us again from Warbringer, and we want to go into Steve Lukather's studio, the Steakhouse, and record a live album with a small audience.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, because actually Pag doesn't like to make studio records.
Oh,
and, really? Yeah, he doesn't like it. Yeah, he's a live guy. And and I'm getting to the point where I can almost pull it off live. So we're going to go in and try and do that. And we had Gene McEwen as our drummer. And the reason I got Gene to begin with was because he's a studio guy. He's it's all about the song and I know what I'm going to do. And that's what I wanted at the time. But then Pag just kind of said, "No, man, we need to make a live record." And he talked me into it. And so I was trying to explain that to Gene. And so we asked Carlos to come in and do that with us because he's back from tour. So he's an amazing drummer who actually met Nick when he was a cameraman when the HBO guys were filming Nick and us at the studio. That's how we met Carlos. He was friends with he went to school with one of the guys. Or no, it was Madison he went to school with. So Carlos is on board. We're going to try and get in there in the next couple months and see what we can do.
Right on.
Hey, the cool thing about it is somehow he got the board. He got the knee board from Abbey Road. He bought it.
So you're going to record a live album with Ohm in Steve Lukather's studio with a small audience with the original board from Abbey Road.
Yep.
I can't top that.
Oh God! Now you're making me nervous.
Yeah. Don't fuck up.
Dude, I think we're gonna go for we're just gonna pay for 2 days, and hopefully we won't have to go for a third day because it's not like there's a lot of money floating around. But
sure,
that's the thing about a live record is if you can pull it off, you're done.
Yeah, you're done. You know? Don't hit a wrong note, you're out. Exactly.
Oh man, I just want to thank everybody from the beginning, all those Megadeth fans, any fans that we have. We really appreciate it. Everything we do is just a labor of love, man. We've been doing it for so long that sometimes I'm not sure there's enough love to go around anymore. But somehow we always just kind of suck it up and keep going.
Yeah,
we're just driven by it, you know what I mean? Just like anybody, if you love playing, you play,
Yeah, exactly. I want to thank, you've mentioned their names a few times, James and Madison.
Yeah.
I don't exactly know who they are, but Madison is completely responsible for getting me in touch with you, so I want to make sure I thank the right people.
Madison, James, all those guys, they're great. They've been through the whole thing with us. So they're like family now. So,
Chris Poland, I got nothing else, man. You blew my mind with a lot of great stuff here. Thank you for being so generous with your Sunday.
Well, Travis, I want to thank you, and I also want to thank one more person. I want to thank Steve Bauer. He's been managing me personally for years now, and he's responsible for a lot of the records that you have that I put out. So. Just a big shout out to him.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Madison. Thank you, James. Yeah, thank you, Chris Poland.
And thank you, Travis, man.
Welcome, dude. My pleasure. You lucky West Coast folk that are anywhere near the baked potato, this dude seems to be in and out of there all the time. Please go see Ohm one time. Just check him out to say that you saw him. And Chris Poland, thanks for your time, man. I appreciate it.
You too, Travis. Have a good day, man.
Later, brother. ahead, nice and clear.
Go ahead.
Visit the site at asthestorygrows.com and subscribe so you don't miss anything.
Special thanks to Brian Patton, who helps me out with the interviews, scheduling, and editing of this show.
Visit the Bandcamp link in the notes of this show for some free cover songs, some free tunes, and merch.
If you like what you heard and would like to help, there's a Patreon link on every episode, or you can look for the dollar sign on the website for one-time donations.
If you can't afford to donate, no problem. Tell a friend, and thank you so much for listening today.
Oh, as the story grows, the more I want to know, the more I want to show you. As the story grows,
we love you. Take care. Bye-bye.